Hi, I'm Nathan Ryder, and welcome to the Viber Survivors podcast, where I talk to PhD graduates about their research, their Viber, and life after the PhD. This is episode 24, and today I'm talking to Dr. Pooky Knight-Smith, who recently completed her PhD at the Institute of Psychiatry, King's College London. Pooky's research area was in child and adolescent mental health, and she completed her PhD over the course of 7 years. I talked to her about her research, her Viber, and what she's up to now. It's really great to be talking to you this morning, Pooky. So to start with, can you tell us all a little bit about the research that you did for your PhD?
Okay, so the kind of thought process behind my PhD was about how to help school staff to recognise and respond to eating disorders in school students. And the kind of project culminated, I guess, in a training day for school staff that was based on consultation with school staff and with students, and also taking clinical best practice and kind of seeing how that could be applied to the school setting.
How did that start then? How did you come to your PhD? In our email conversations before the podcast, you mentioned that it took place over 7 years in total.
Yes.
So what was the start?
It took me a while. it was quite sort of serendipitous, to be honest. So it's all inspired originally by my own background. So I suffered from an eating disorder when I was at school, and my school tried their best to be supportive, but there wasn't really any guidance available to them about, you know, what they should be doing. And some of the actions that they took, looking back on it now, possibly weren't, you know, the most helpful in terms of my long-term recovery. So that kind of was one of the things that inspired it. But how I actually ended up doing the PhD was that I was working for a teacher training company, and I'd written a course about eating disorders in schools, which turned out to be really popular. So I decided to try and run a conference on the topic, and I was looking for a keynote speaker who specialised in this area. And there wasn't anybody. There was nobody that was doing work in this particular area. And while I was looking for someone, I stumbled across who now have been my PhD supervisors and are kind of somewhat superstars in the field, and they said, there isn't anybody, but we've got a pot of funding and you've got the right kind of background for it, why don't you come and join the team? So I did.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is serendipitous, isn't it?
It really was, yeah.
Yeah. How did the PhD start then? So you mentioned that you had this training course. Was that something that you evaluated or developed through the PhD, or
no,
was that just kind of the starting point?
No, that's it. That was kind of the inspiration, if you like. But the PhD was done completely separately. So I continued working for the training company. I was working for them full time, and then began my studies on my PhD. And in terms of how it started, so my project was part of a very big project, a kind of £5 or £6 million National Institute of Health research project, which was looking at trying to provide answers around various questions to do with anorexia. I started off by working with the rest of the team and seeing what they'd done so far, and trying to look at what best practice might be able to be applied in schools. And then my next step was to do some consultation with school staff and with students to get a really good understanding of what the problems were that they were facing, what they thought they needed help with, and what had worked elsewhere, you know, what kind of best practice we could apply. And that was meant to be quite a small piece of work, but turned out to become, rather large. I ended up interviewing and surveying about 800 or 900 members of school staff and about 500 students. So, it got huge.
So when you said then interviewing and sort of surveying, so did you actually speak to, I mean, that's nearly 1,500 people in total.
No, I didn't speak to them all. I spoke to lots and lots of them informally along the way. So they all completed surveys, and a good couple of hundred of the school staff were involved in focus groups, some of them that were formally written up as research and some of them which just informally fed into the project along the way.
How did things develop with your research? Because 7 years is a long time, and I know you had a break in the middle or some at some points, but how did things develop over the 7 years?
Doing it over quite a long period was quite good, actually, because it meant that I had a lot longer for things like, you know, when I was doing surveys and that sort of thing for feedback to come back in on them. But in terms of how it developed, the field changed quite a lot. So at the beginning, when I was thinking about what my training program that I was always working towards would look like, I thought it needed to be a program that was about recognizing eating disorders and then giving teachers the information they needed in order to refer pupils on for help outside, so with the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Service, for example. But throughout the course of the project, then funding was cut and cut and cut. And the situation in schools now is that it's very difficult to get a referral to CAMHS, the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services. And so I had to think really carefully about what was most useful for me to provide. So I still provide some of that initial information I'd hoped to, but I provide a lot more practical advice about what you can do in school, assuming that essentially you can't get help from outside now as well.
What sort of things did you have to do with, I guess, like ethical considerations? Because as a mathematician, I did that sort of thing didn't come up, but was that something that was important that you had to consider a lot during the PhD or not?
Yes, it was a complete and utter nightmare, to be honest.
Oh dear.
Yeah, it was. So everything I did, every survey that I held, every focus group that I held formally, needed to go through the ethics procedure. And those, you know, the documents looking to seek consent from the King's College Ethics Committee would run into, you know, thousands and thousands of words, and would sometimes get battered back and forth. So it could take, you know, 6 or 8 months to get ethics through. I mean, it's very important, obviously. It's a tricky topic, but yeah, it again, another reason why I was glad I was part-time, to be honest, because, you know, those kind of timescales could have been very problematic otherwise. But they were quite informative. I mean, a lot of the questions that I had to answer during the ethics procedure were good questions, and they did probably make my research stronger, but it did feel quite frustrating at the time, and it did change what I did. So I held lots of focus groups with school staff, but I actually opted not to do that formally with students, because getting the ethics through would have been very, very difficult. So,
because you took a break, was it exactly sort of halfway through the PhD, or was it just at some point you took a break to become a mother?
I'm trying to think when it would have been. About halfway, I would say. Yeah.
So, what was it? Did you completely step back from your research and work during that time, or was it a case of, you know, things were happening, but I suppose you weren't formally on the clock? How did that work for you?
Yeah, so I wasn't formally on the clock. I was being kind of paid on maternity leave and adoption leave, and technically I wasn't allowed to be doing any work. But as you do when you have a little bit of time and actually a bit more space than usual, because I wasn't working, then I did kind of continue, you know, I kept myself up to date with reading and such, although I wasn't going out and collecting any evidence. I did speak at a couple of conferences during that time as well, and I remember that being very strange. The first time that I left, at the point when I just had the one child, when I'd given birth to Lyra 3 or 4 months previous, I remember going out to a conference and just feeling that I needed to wear a badge that said, you know, I'm mummy, because I'd been nothing else for the last 3 months. So essentially it kind of ticked along, and I did a little bit, but no, technically I wasn't meant to be doing anything.
Okay. How was it returning sort of full-time, part-time to the PhD after the maternity and the adoption leave?
It was fantastic, because what I found, and you might well have found the same, that becoming a parent makes you much more effective in your use of time. So you've got a lot more draws on your time, but your time's a lot more precious to you. So I found actually that I got a lot more done within my time, that I was a lot more structured. I had a much clearer idea about what I wanted to do. And the other thing about it was that once I had my own children, suddenly my project became even more important to me, because I kind of felt like I owed it to everyone else's children to try and keep them as safe as I could from this horrible illness. I was even more motivated, really.
What have the outputs been then? Obviously, you've written your thesis, but what were the conclusions or the results of your research?
So basically I ended up running a feasibility study of this training program for school staff about recognizing and managing eating disorders, and that was relatively small scale in the end, but it came back very, very positive. What I showed was that using my training program, school staff could increase their confidence, their attitudes and their knowledge within the space of a day, and that was maintained 3 months later as well. But it's kind of early days for that, and I'm in a strong position to apply for further funding to run a larger trial. I'm not sure at the moment whether or not I'll do that. But there's been lots of other outputs along the way as well. So I've written a small book called The Eating Disorders Pocketbook, which has proved quite helpful for teachers. I've written self-harm and eating disorders policies, which are used quite widely in schools now. And I've had a few papers which actually form part of my thesis. And I've spoken at quite a lot of conferences, but mainly I've just been kind of getting myself out there and training people. So my training program that I developed as part of my PhD has kind of morphed and grown into something different, which I deliver quite a lot on a more informal basis as a freelancer now. So yeah, it's actually being used.
That's brilliant. Let's talk about, I suppose, the end of your PhD, because you had your VIVA quite recently, within the last month or so.
But yes.
When did you submit?
I submitted at the end of January, so I had a very, very short lead-in time to my VIVA.
Okay. So once you'd submitted, what did you do in terms of preparation for your VIVA?
Very little. I just need to say in my defence at this time that, you know, I work full time, I have two small children, and I had a lot going on. The difficulty specifically with my VIVA was that the timing of my VIVA came about because one of my examiners was going to be in the country for a 3-day eating disorders conference. Now, I was on the scientific committee for that conference, so I was heavily involved in the organisation of it, and I was speaking every day. So that really was taking up a huge amount of any spare time that I had. And then my VIVA followed about 3 days after that, and there was weekend in between. So I didn't do a huge amount. I read your book, Nathan, which was very helpful and gave me an idea about to expect. And I reread my thesis and I thought about some of the questions that I might get asked, but I really didn't. I didn't do enough. It made for quite an unpleasant VIVA in terms of how I felt about it, but I passed. So
outside of your preparation, was there any kind of anxiety or stress about the VIVA, or was it just not there because you had so many other things going on?
I was anxious about the fact that I hadn't prepared enough, and I became aware of quite how much preparation people who are focusing full time on a PhD might spend on it, because obviously if you're doing a PhD all the time and then you've submitted, then suddenly you have this time, don't you? You're not doing anything and you don't have another job maybe, and so you'd have time to prepare in a way that I didn't. So I was anxious on that level, and also just when you've worked on something for 7 years and you really care about it. I mean, I'm ever so passionate about the topic. I was a little bit anxious from that point of view. But at the same time, you know, I was going to be doing a VIVA on the topic of eating disorders that was directly following this massive international conference that I'd been involved in organising, where I'd had wonderful feedback on work that I'd presented. And, you know, it's a lovely community. And so that helped to give me a bit of a boost. But yeah, I was nervous about the actual thing itself, I guess.
How did the day start, the day of your VIVA? When was it during the day?
It was right over lunch. So I had to arrive at 11, but the examiners actually were meeting at about 11:30. My supervisor just wanted to make sure I got there on time, I think. So they met at 11:30 for about half an hour. And then I went down and we started the VIVA at about 12, and it lasted for 2.5 hours, right over lunch. We kind of had intended that we'd break for lunch, but it just never really worked that way. So, we just kind of carried on and nibbled on grapes.
So how did things start with the VIVA? Were you asked to do a presentation, or was it just they started asking questions?
Yeah, they just started asking questions. I wasn't asked to do a presentation, and I didn't get any, I kind of looked a little bit about what I might expect at the beginning, and I'd sort of been expected to maybe summarise what I'd done or that sort of thing, and there wasn't really any lead-in like that. It was literally kind of a few friendly questions about completely different things, and then bam, straight in there. They just literally started going through my thesis, which they had in front of them in hard copy.
And so did they go through your thesis more or less cover to cover, or were they sort of cherry picking things that they wanted to talk about?
Yeah, so just to kind of explain, my thesis was written as a series of publications.
Okay.
So I had a very long introductory chapter, and then I had three published papers, and then I had a final study which wasn't published yet, so that was written as the traditional chapter, and then there was a discussion chapter. So they didn't really ask any questions at all about the published papers because they were already peer-reviewed and published. They had, you know, really nothing to say about that. I'd already been through that with the peer reviewers. But they did ask me various questions about the introduction. They asked me basically nothing about the discussion, actually, which was sad because that was the area where I felt strongest. But yeah, they didn't really ask about that. And I did get grilled a lot about my stats, which was, yeah, possibly my weakest area.
What was their focus? Were they trying to get you to explain things or to just have some kind of general discussion?
It was a bit of both. I think I felt a little bit like they were just trying to test that I understood how to be a scientist because, you know, my thesis and all the various other outputs surrounding it kind of proved that, you know, I'd clearly done the work and that it clearly had had an impact. And it was so different than other things that had happened in the field that there was no question about whether or not it was novel. So the contribution question was fine. But yeah, I think they just wanted to check that actually I was a decent scientist and I'd conducted research in the right way and I'd thought about all the right questions. So yeah, their questions were quite searching, actually, and lots of them had me having to think back to stuff I'd done at university rather than anything I'd necessarily thought too much about during my PhD, to be honest. So it was quite hard.
What was the most challenging part of the Viva, you know, if that sort of stuck in your mind, if you've not kind of blotted it out like I did with mine?
Yeah, I have a little bit. This is the silly thing. I think probably, so my Viva lasted 2.5 hours. And I think probably of that 2.5 hours, if I'm honest, about 15 minutes of it was probably very difficult where I felt that I didn't know the answers at all. But in my mind, it felt like, you know, 2 hours, 15 was the difficult stuff. Because, yeah, you play it back differently. But I think for me, the most difficult thing was just having very searching questions about my statistics and not having the confidence to stand by what I had done. Because actually, the moment that I left the room and I went and talked to my supervisor and said, you know, some of the questions that had come up and, you know, how they questioned some of my methodology, then my supervisor was able to say, but you know exactly why you did that. We've discussed this. You know, they're talking on the basis of much, much larger studies, and then their questions be valid, but with a small study such as yours, that, you know, those questions just don't hold water. But I didn't have the confidence to, you know, kind of come back like that.
So that was challenging. Was it stressful at the same time or not?
The bits, yeah, where I felt that I didn't have a good answer, it felt very stressful. And I think, you know, by the end of it, I'd convinced myself they were going to fail me, but they didn't.
You mentioned that when the Viva was finished, you went and spoke to your supervisor. Yeah. What happened next?
So what happened next was, so I went and spoke to my supervisor and we had about half an hour while my examiners met and discussed the outcome. And then they came and fetched me and they allowed my supervisor to come too to give me the kind of outcome. Probably the longest half an hour of my life, I think, waiting for them to do that. But thankfully, when I went back in, then the first thing they told me was that I had passed. And honestly, I can't really remember much of what was said after that. It was just such a relief. So I kind of awaited the examiner's report, which, you know, listed the corrections, and yeah, that's still kind of on the to-do list, to be honest, but yeah.
So do you know, you've got your list of corrections though, you know what you have to do?
Yes. Yeah. And they're very, you know, they're very helpful. They've outlined exactly what I need to do. It's very, very straightforward. It's just a question of finding the 25th hour in the day to do them, but
yeah. Your Viva was quite recent, but you spent a long time working on the PhD. So what does your PhD mean to you?
Wow, that's a really interesting question. What does my PhD mean to me? Gosh, no one's ever asked me that before. I think it's, I never entered into this wanting a PhD. I just entered into it because I was passionate about the topic and I really wanted the research to be done. And it seemed that I was quite a good person to do it. But as I've worked and worked and worked towards it, I feel that the PhD itself is a recognition of, you know, that hard work, the kind of hours spent alongside work, alongside children, alongside everything else. And also it's instantly given me more credibility. So I work a lot with schools and other settings, talking about mental health issues, and training staff about how to recognize and manage and all that sort of thing. And just being able to be called doctor, it sounds silly, but it makes a massive difference to how people respond, and how much they'll pay me too.
That always helps, doesn't it?
Indeed.
Because your thesis was mostly a collection of papers that you've done, and it's talking about things that have had a real world impact.
Yeah.
So where do you go from there?
Well, in terms of following up, the key thing on my agenda is writing a book. So Jessica Kingsley Publishing have contracted me to write a book based on the kind of practical outcomes of my thesis. So that'll be a practical guide for teachers about eating disorders and self-harm, actually. And that's the manuscript for that's due in September. So that's kind of the next big thing on the to-do list. But more generally, I gave up my kind of full-time job. I used to work in social media alongside my research, and I gave up my full-time job about a year ago now to focus entirely on working in mental health. And so now I'm just spending more time focusing on that, really, just trying to make sure that as many people as possible are in a good position to support young people who have mental health difficulties, which sounds very trite, but it's kind of my passion and I'm really enjoying it. And yeah, so that's what I'm up to, really.
That's great. I've got a couple of questions that sort of finishes off about advice for people starting their PhD or for people who've got their Viva, but I just wanted to ask one quick question, if that's okay, about being part-time.
Yeah.
Because most of the people who come on the podcast have done their PhD full-time. I just wondered, because you mentioned that perhaps it was an advantage having that sort of longer time.
Yeah.
To reflect on things as you went along, but are there any other advantages, or were there for you at least, advantages in doing your PhD part-time?
I mean, I think there are advantages and there are disadvantages. So in terms of advantages, having longer, A, you develop more as a person, you are able to draw on other areas of life rather than being in that kind of research bubble, which I'm quite aware of that sometimes colleagues can be in. And also just things like if you want to publish as a series of papers, as I have, just having the time to actually, you know, get them in, get them back, get them edited and get them published is very helpful. I think it helped me to have a lot more of a balance and for my PhD not to kind of overtake my life, because a lot of people doing PhDs do seem to find it quite stressful, particularly towards the end. But when you have, you know, lots of other things going on as well, and then it's just more of a question of time management and fitting it in, which helps you to keep a bit of a sense of priority. But in terms of, you know, disadvantages, the one thing that I was a bit sad about was that the team I was working with were an absolutely phenomenal group of people, really, really, really lovely group of people. But I worked completely remotely and would only go and visit them relatively infrequently. And so I never really got to be kind of a part of that team in the same way that a full-time person might do. And I also didn't get the same sort of idea sharing and support that you would get from being part of a team full-time. So that was a disadvantage. And the other thing was it did sometimes feel like I was never going to finish. I mean, 7 years is a really long time.
But you did.
I did.
You did. To finish off then, the two questions I always ask. Firstly, what advice would you give someone who was starting a PhD?
I think if I was starting again, the one thing I'd think really carefully about right from the start is what I was aiming for at the end. And I mean that very, very practically. So thinking about what my thesis would look like and trying to build my PhD quite logically around that. And I was very lucky because the way that I developed my studies told a very natural story when I came to put it together in a thesis. But I know lots of people for whom that was not the case, and that made writing up very much harder. The other thing I think I would say is just not to be afraid, really, and to trust yourself. So I've felt a lot during my PhD almost like an imposter, and you feel like at some point somebody's going to question you and say, well, what makes you think you know so much about this? But actually very, very quickly you become the person who knows more about this one tiny niche than anyone else does. And the sooner you get over the fact that actually you do know some stuff and you put yourself out there and you speak at conferences and you talk with other academics as if they're on a level with you, then the more that you learn from them and the more interesting it is for you too.
Final question then is, what advice would you give someone preparing for their Viva?
My number one piece of advice would be to read Nathan's book. genuinely. I really
people think I've paid you.
No, genuinely found the book really, really helpful. I found it very reassuring. Oh, and I didn't have a clue what to expect of a Viva before I went in. And it seems, having read the book and spoken to you subsequently, that that's because they're all completely different. But actually, you know, there are some things that you can do to prepare. The other thing I'd say is probably to spend more than 5 hours preparing, as I did. Having said that, I did only spend 5 hours preparing, and I did pass. And at the end of the day, you either pass or you don't, and I've got the same outcome. So maybe, you know, there's a question there about quite how much time needs to be dedicated to preparation. I think you need to do enough, but you know, you're aiming to pass at the end of the day. It's not like A levels where you get an A, a B, a C, or a D. You know, you pass or you don't. I'm still doctor.
Yep. And it's a great feeling being a doctor, isn't it?
It is. It really is. It's not going to get old ever.
Pookie, it was really great to talk to you today. Thanks so much for your time.
No, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That's all for episode 24. Many thanks to Pookie for joining us today and for sharing her research and her experiences. If you've got any comments or questions about this or any other episode, then please get in touch, either by posting directly on the site, viva-survivors.com, by emailing podcast@viva-survivors.com, or by tweeting @viva-survivors, or to me, @drryder. It would be great to hear from you, especially if you'd like to appear on a future episode. Until next time, I'm Nathan Ryder, and thanks for listening.